Welcome to Down Among the Donkeys, a podcast from the Donkey Sanctuary. In 13 episodes, we are telling the story behind the founding of one of the biggest equine charities in the world. Down Among the Donkeys by Dr. Elizabeth Svensson. Chapter 2. A charity is formed. As we walked into the hotel on a Saturday in March 1966, the staff all walked out. I am sure there was nothing personal in it, and we learned later that new owners and previous staff never seemed to mix in the hotel world. A dance was booked for the evening. There was a large bar to man, and apparently 25 people were coming to have dinner in the restaurant. To say that evening was a shambles would be the most complete understatement. We were lucky that while in Cornwall, we had made friends with Mo and Keith, who had had a little hotel experience. They came to help initiate us, and thank goodness they were there, because we rushed madly between kitchen, dining room and bar, where over 100 people gathered and drank enormous quantities of most peculiar drinks, which we had to ask about before being able to serve. Most of the clientele appeared to arrive on motorbikes, and eventually, at just after 12:30, Niels went into the ballroom and asked the band to stop playing and close for the evening since fights were breaking out left, right and centre, and we felt the situation was getting completely out of control. When finally the last unwilling guest had been physically pushed out of the hotel and the big doors were locked, we all sank down in the bar and miserably wondered what on earth we had let ourselves in for. During the next week, we managed to start accumulating some staff, and the next weekend was in fact a little easier, although peppered with small incidents, such as the one where our new chef took a carving knife to one of the kitchen hands who was not doing his job well enough. We both felt completely wretched and realised we had made the most terrible mistake, assuming firstly that the hotel industry was something one could walk into easily, and secondly, that one could make a good living from it just like that. An upstairs room in the hotel over the large ballroom had to be made into a flat with two bedrooms for us, and we certainly found it different from the acres of room we'd had in the past. We had not forgotten our pledge to adopt our fourth child, and had made one attempt in Cornwall. We thought that Paul, our eldest son, would benefit greatly by going into a small boarding school on the coast near our home to have more individual teaching attention. At the delightful little school he attended was an abandoned baby in the care of Cornwall health authorities. He seemed desperately in need of a home, as his parents were unable to care for him. And so we made the necessary applications through the county council. The papers for this child were eventually passed on to the National Children's Adoption Association, and Miss Hilary Halpin from there got in touch with us and advised us officially that we could start arrangements for adoption. We were all so excited. He seemed such a dear little boy, and Paul was fond of him already. Lisa, our eldest daughter, offered to go to the same school as Paul so she too could get to know Rupert, and it would be less traumatic for him when he eventually arrived with us. After Lisa had spent a term at the school, we received a notification from the Adoption Association to say that, regretfully, the child had been withdrawn from the adoption list, and it would no longer be possible for us to consider adoption. We went up to see Miss Halpin and told her that we were quite willing to take in any other child in desperate need. We didn't mind which sex, and that we were prepared to take one that could not normally be placed for any particular reason. We filled in forms galore and provided references, and we both had to have medical examinations. The paperwork was laborious, but we supposed the association was doing its best to make sure we were suitable parents. On the 19th of February 1968, we received a telephone call from Miss Halpin to tell us that they had a baby on their books whom they thought was extremely suitable for us. She was a little girl. Her parents were not English, and there were certain medical problems which made her unadoptable. They suggested we came up to see the baby, and along with the letter came a little form saying, "We would be glad if you would bring a suitcase with you for any clothes or possessions the baby may have, and a shawl. Will you please also bring a carry cot with appropriate cot bedding? The baby will have a tin of food, which he or she is having at present, a bottle already made up for the journey, and full directions for feeding." It was suddenly very exciting to think that we were going to have another daughter, and we held an immediate family conference to make sure the children were still as enthusiastic as they had been earlier on. It was really super to see their faces light up in anticipation of the new addition to the family, and the fact that the baby would need extra care seemed to make it all even more worthwhile. It seemed funny packing a carry cot, but we put all the baby's needs in it, including the shawl, and received a very excited send-off from the children and the staff at the hotel as we set off to catch the train for London. We had decided to travel first class, so we could look after the baby properly on the way home, and got two seats in a compartment already occupied by a businessman and a very elderly couple who could only be described as posh. Niels slung the carry cot onto the luggage rack, left the newspapers on the seat, and we both went up the train to get breakfast. Back in our compartment, we found the elderly couple no longer there, and the gentleman reading and smiling away in the corner of the compartment. 2 minutes later, he put down his book and said, "I really must tell you what happened when you went out." We were quite surprised, as people rarely talk in first-class compartments, but he obviously had a great deal on his mind. "The moment you went out," he said, "the lady started getting at her husband. Fancy," she said, "fancy throwing that poor little thing up there on the luggage rack and not even bothering to see if it was all right. Get straight up there, Henry, and have a look at it." "Darling," Henry said, "we shouldn't really interfere. They must know what they are doing. Henry, you are to get up there straight away and see if that baby is all right. I am not going to sit in this carriage and allow that sort of cruelty to take place." Apparently, poor Henry stood on tiptoe on the seat, but could not see in. "Lift it down," the wife had insisted. "Lift it down and look at it. It might be smothering." And so, they lifted the carry cot down onto the seat, and their surprise to find an empty carry cot was only exceeded by their extreme embarrassment. Apparently, they had put the cot back and gone to another compartment. Of course, we arrived at the adoption agency far too early for our appointment at 3:30, so we wandered round Harrods. I had never been to their antique department before, and was immensely excited by the beautiful things for sale. Suddenly, I saw the most beautiful pair of Georgian candlesticks. "Golly, Niels," I said, "those are absolutely fantastic. I wonder how much they are." Poor Niels, he could see that look in my eyes, and knowing my love of Georgian silver, knew what was about to happen. Niels' face was a treat as I signed the cheque. It was one of the biggest we had made out, but I knew that it was a really good pair of sticks. "What with a pair of sticks and a baby, it is becoming quite a feat," said Niels. At 3:30 exactly, we found ourselves talking to Miss Halpin. "Your baby is lying on a table in this little room. There is a pair of weighing scales next to the baby, and we will leave you alone with her to make your minds up," she said, opening the door to a room where there was an enormous table, and lying in the middle of it, stark naked, was our little Sarah. I don't think either of us could say she was the most beautiful child we had ever seen. She had congenitally dislocated hips, which made her tiny form on the table look very strange. She was covered in a rash, her nose was running as she had a slight cold, and her eyes were most definitely going in opposite directions. We stood together at the side of the table, just looking. She looked at us, and her little face was all screwed and puckered up. "For heaven's sake," said Niels, Get some nappies on and put a shawl on and let's get her back home. And so little Sarah joined our family. The formalities at that stage were almost nil. We signed the Adoption Association's form, and then it was back to the station in a taxi and down to Exeter. Our companion from the morning's journey was waiting on the station, and I think he enjoyed as much as we did Sarah having her first bottle on the way home and our obvious joy and enthusiasm at the new addition to the family. We didn't get back until nearly 11 and crept quietly in the front door of the hotel, Niels carrying the cot. There in the lounge were all our friends and children waiting to greet the new little baby. They had all brought gifts for Sarah, and Niels was so overwhelmed he opened 2 bottles of champagne there and then, and we all drank a toast to the latest Svensson. The next day, our doctor saw Sarah and arranged for her to see an eye specialist immediately, as obviously her sight was very impaired, and she was going to need a series of operations to restore proper vision. In fact, we didn't realise until she started crawling and toddling just how bad it really was. Her little head was always a mass of bruises as she walked into things, and we were very lucky to have as good a children's eye specialist as Mr. Cantrell from Exeter. The doctor looked at her little congenitally dislocated hips, and although he felt she would probably need a plaster cast in the very near future, he decided to sort out the eye problem first, and advised massage of her legs every time I changed her nappy. The actual legal adoption officially took place after the many formalities, including court medicals for ourselves and the baby, on the 17th of June 1968, and on Thursday the 20th of June, Neil's birthday, we were able to announce in the births column of the Daily Telegraph, Svensson, adoption, by Betty, née Knowles, and Niels Svensson, of the Sulston Hotel, Ottery St. Mary, a daughter, Sarah Anna, a sister for Lisa, Paul, and Clive. It was lovely being able to look after the baby on my own. There had always been my work with Lisa, Paul, and Clive, but having the hotel meant working from home rather than having to go to an office. We took on a lovely girl called Sue Rist, whose sister had been working in the hotel since we bought it, to be Sarah's nanny, and also resident nanny to all the children who arrived at the hotel. She was extremely good with Sarah and the other children, and as the hotel got busier, it was essential that she was there all the time. It was August 1969, when donkeys really began to come into my life in a big way. We had all missed Donko since we left West Chinook, and while idly looking through the pages of the Exeter Express and Echo, the local paper, my eyes suddenly became riveted on one small advertisement. Livestock for sale was the heading. Pedigree donkey mare for sale. Kennetbury Martha. Apply Mr. Mogar. It had a Ottery St. Mary telephone number. Niels was unable to resist my pleadings to ring up immediately, and as a result, a few minutes later, we jumped into the car with all the children and drove up to West Hill, where we met Naughty Face, officially known as Kennetbury Martha, for the very first time. She had such beautiful, limpid eyes and such an intelligent face that I really have to blame her for everything that happened after. She cost £45, and Mr. Mogar promised to deliver her when a stable had been built and a fence erected around the field in front of the Sulston Hotel. I bought 3 bales of straw to make her a nice deep bed. Niels, with the help of Keith, our friend from Cornwall, and Herb Fry, the gardener, got the work done, and 1 week later, Naughty Face arrived. Down the ramp of the wagon she walked, looked at Niels and me calmly, and then trotted off to inspect her field and shelter. I stood by the rails, absolutely entranced by the way she moved, the intelligence used in examining her new surroundings, and the way that every few moments she would come back to me at the fence to gently nuzzle my hand as if to say, "Please don't go, I'm only looking round a moment." I was hooked. That night at the hotel was busy, but I slipped out 4 or 5 times to make sure Naughty Face was all right, and each time found her standing in her stable, busily eating the straw I had so carefully put down as her floor. We didn't get to bed until after 1 a.m, and we were woken up by a mournful hee-haw at 6 o'clock the next morning. Naughty Face was lonely. As she paced around and around the paddock, every now and then giving a mournful bray, it became apparent that she needed a companion badly. Mr. Morgar had told me of the Donkey Breed Society, and I rang up their secretary, Susan Greenway, who advised me to buy another donkey. Once you have got 2, they will probably settle quite happily and won't be quite so noisy, she said, and recommended a Mrs. Joan Spencer, who she knew had a donkey for sale. Mrs. Spencer came to visit us at the hotel, bringing in her loose box Angelina, whom she thought would make a good companion for Naughty Face. She pronounced Naughty Face to be in foal, and I was delighted to think that we'd soon have a growing tribe of donkeys, especially when she advised me that Angelina was also in foal. We became intensely interested in Angelina's and Naughty Face's condition. Naughty Face was a lovely grey colour. Angelina was a deep chocolate brown, and Mrs. Spencer had told us she had mated her with a white stallion, and we could possibly get a broken-coloured donkey, that is, one both brown and white. I found myself ringing Susan more and more frequently for advice as we waited in great excitement. Naughty Face had a delightful filly foal named Superdocious, but unfortunately Angelina's, a deep chocolate-coloured foal, died at birth. I joined the Donkey Breed Society and took up Susan's kind invitation to visit her beautiful stud farm. Niels enjoyed the visit every bit as much as I did, and Susan Greenway showed us St. Paddy of Kennetbury, a superb stallion whom we later bought. Whilst the main reason was our love of donkeys, prices of well-bred stock were reaching as high as £200, and the idea of breeding donkeys was to make a bit of money for ourselves too. The flat within the hotel was now far too small for ourselves and the 4 children. Paul was at boarding school but home for the holidays, and Lisa was at the local grammar school. We were lucky to purchase the house on ground close to the hotel, which had 4 bedrooms, 4 acres of land, and some stabling facilities. We moved into it in January 1970. Once we had the land and the stabling facilities, I decided to realise an ambition and start breeding seriously. My stud was registered, and I became the area representative for the Southwest for the Donkey Breed Society, helping both breeders and donkey owners with problems. All went well, and the donkeys began to build up. Then, in December 1970, out of curiosity, I went to visit Exeter Market on a horse sale day. I wandered past the pens of horses, some superb, others looking poor and frightened, but all with numbers on and with owners attending them. But right at the fringe of the covered pen, where the wagons were unloading, I saw a sight which was to change not only my life, but the lives of my husband, 4 children, and many other people whom at that time I was not even aware existed. It was quite simply a small pen, suitable for 2 ponies perhaps, into which 7 small, terrified donkeys were crammed so tightly they could hardly move. Their condition was indescribable, and I was just rooted to the ground in horror. Their coats were long and full of lice, their feet overgrown and twisted, and they were all in a state of shock. Several rough-looking men were hanging over the rails, and I asked who owned the donkeys. One nodded at a younger man busy talking, and I waited impatiently for him to finish. "How much for that poor donkey there?" I pointed at the worst one. He didn't even look to see which one. £45, he said. I swallowed hard. It looked as if it had only a few days to live. and the price was obviously exorbitant. The donkey looked at me, and I looked at the donkey. That was it. "I'll have it," I said. "Sorry," said the young man. "I've just sold the business to this gentleman here. They're all his now." And he turned away and disappeared between the wagons. £55, said the new owner. "Sorry, take it or leave it." I walked away from the pen for a few minutes to try and collect my thoughts, before turning back just in time to see the last donkey driven out of the pen and into a lorry, tail twisted cruelly behind him to speed his departure. I had thought too long. I didn't sleep that night. Neither did Niels when I told him what had happened to those donkeys. By chance, I did meet the same donkeys again. Once again, I was unable to help when an advertisement in the paper for a skewbald donkey mare appeared, and we went to see her. She was in a small stable and was not in a very good condition, although she had beautiful markings. We could hear other donkeys in the next stable, but the man told us that all the other donkeys were sold, and he wasn't authorised to show us any more. But when he walked off, curiosity overcame us, and we slipped into the next shed. In the dim light, packed in tightly, were about 40, all in appalling condition. They had no food, so Niels broke open 4 or 5 bales of hay lying nearby, which we spread for them, and which they started to munch with desperate eagerness. I was sure I recognised my donkey from the market. Neither of us could talk on the way home. We were just shattered and knew something had to be done. Next day, when I rang regarding the broken coloured donkey, I asked whether I could buy any donkeys from the next stable. There was a short silence. Then I was told they were all sold to a donkey sanctuary. April of the next year finally convinced me of my dedication to donkey welfare. A member of the Donkey Breed Society had asked me if I would help them get a family donkey. They wanted a grey mare about 5 years old, and none of our members had one for sale. Seeing one advertised by a dealer, I arranged for it to be delivered to the Salston so that I could ensure it would prove a sound purchase. Arriving back from a trip to the cash and carry for the hotel, Niels told me the donkey had been delivered and was in the field with the others. Sure enough, there she was, and I walked over to look her over. She was terrified. I decided not to press my attentions then, thinking it would be better when she joined the others for a feed at tea time. Still she would not come, and we went to bed without having got near her. The donkeys were noisy in the early morning, and dawn had only just broken when we looked through the window to see what all the fuss was about. Smarty was lying down in the field. The noise was, of course, coming from Naughtyface and Angelina, always in charge, and they were standing by an inert grey form in the middle of the field. "Come on," I said to Niels, "that new donkey is in trouble." We pulled on old trousers and sweaters and rushed up the field. She lay stretched out, breathing shallowly and unable to get up. "We'll have to get some help, darling, to carry her down to the shed. She will have to be taken in," Neil said. But even as he was talking, we were both trying to lift her, and to our surprise, we found we could pick her up between us. She was virtually a living skeleton. Carefully, we carried her to a small shed by the back door, laid her on a deep layer of straw, and covered her with a blanket. She was no longer frightened. She was too ill. I heated some milk, thinned it with water, added glucose, and gently spooned it down her throat. Niels fixed the infrared bulb over her, but then he had to go to the hotel for an 8 o'clock start. I sat on, spooning milk and glucose. The vet arrived and shook his head sadly. "You've got a real job on," he said. "She's almost starved to death." He gave her a vitamin injection and promised to call the next day. I shook out some fresh, tantalising hay by her head and went inside to ring the dealer who had delivered her. He expressed great surprise. She was the best of the lot that arrived. What could the others have been like, I wondered. asking him to call and see for himself, and this he promised to do. Back in the shed, the donkey had got her head up, and to my great joy had a mouthful of hay. I knelt by her, and moving the blanket began to brush her gently. Great handfuls of lice-infested hair came away, and sore after sore became evident. I was still gently working by lunchtime, but I was winning on one side at least, and the lice powder was surely taking effect. I wished I'd put some on myself. By evening she was standing up, shakily, but up. I gave her a very tiny amount of bran soaked in warm water and black treacle, and this vanished quickly. My younger son Clive came in and said, "She looks quite different now she's brushed out. Why don't we call her Smarty?" It was a long battle, but we won, and Smarty joined our herd. Having the hotel proved a great advantage for the welfare of donkeys. Visitors seeing them in the field made inquiries and were almost always interested, contributing funds too. Information began to come in as to where donkeys were in distress, and an urgent call came one boiling hot August day from a guest at the hotel who was visiting a local resort. "Mrs. Svensson, I do wish you would come. This poor little donkey has been giving rides all day and has collapsed. They've left it lying at the side of the beach under a sack, but it's still alive." Niels was away, so I jumped in my car and drove off. When I got to the beach, the hotel guest was waiting anxiously. "They've got it in that wagon just leaving," she said. I followed the wagon, and after a few miles it arrived at a rough field. It was met by a man, obviously the owner, who started talking to the driver. He was large and rough. Together they climbed into the back of the lorry. I peered in. "Excuse me, is that your donkey?" I asked. A stream of bad language emerged, to the effect that she was a lazy bag and had ruined his day's trade. "Can I have a look at her, please?" "No, clear off. She'll be all right after a rest. Those buggers just need a clout on the head, and then they behave. I should have been on the beach myself and not let that young girl have 'em." "Get up," he yelled at the donkey and brandished a large stick and struck her on the quarters. I felt sick. "I'll buy her if you like," I said. "She's not much use to you. What do you want for her?" "She'll be all right when she's had a taste of this," he said, and struck her again. "If you strike her again, I'll kill you." It stopped him. He laughed. I suppose it was an idle threat, but I have never been able to accept violence towards defenceless creatures. "I'll sell her for £40, he said. "I'll give you £35, delivered to the Salston Hotel." He lifted his stick again. "All right, £40, but delivered." My heart was making thumping noises, but the donkey had lifted her head and was looking at me. He climbed out of the wagon. "Where's the cash, then?" I made out a cheque and scribbled a receipt for him to sign on a piece of paper. The driver set off for Ottery St. Mary, and as the truck left safely, I turned to the owner and said, "I'll tell the RSPCA of this, and if there's ever a repeat of this ill treatment again, I shall be back." I passed the wagon and led it home. Niels was there, concerned about my tear-stained face, but as always he understood and helped to gently unload the donkey. Once again the vet hurried out, once again he shook his head. "She's about 45 years old and she's had a heart attack. I'll do my best, but..." In the same little stable in which we had nursed Smarty, the old lady fought for her life, and she did fight. We spoon-fed her, she had injections twice a day, and of course hot bran mash with black treacle, which she was able to enjoy. 3 days later she was standing up in the yard. The guest who had rescued her came to have a look. "She really is a lucky lady now," she said, and lucky lady she became. She improved steadily, but was not really able to hold her own with the other donkeys. By this time we had Neil's stepfather, Sven Iversen, living on his own in Exeter, and he had a beautiful orchard, he offered to give Lucky Lady a home until she was able to fend for herself. As space was a big problem, this seemed ideal, and an extremely close relationship built up between the two. As he obviously never carried a stick or mistreated her in any way, Lucky Lady began to regain her confidence in human beings, and indeed, to get a bit of her own back. He had to be extremely careful only to bring the very best hay into the field. Any poor quality material was inspected immediately, and before he had time to get to the gate, she would trot in front of him, turn round and give him a not too gentle kick, just to let him know he was not fully appreciated. After 3 years of this love-hate relationship, the orchard was sold, and Lucky Lady returned to us. The very sad day came when it was kinder to put her to sleep, a decision we do have to take when the really old donkeys are beginning to suffer. Locally, I became known as the Donkey Lady, and found I had gained an overnight reputation of being eccentric, not quite what I was after. By now, we seemed to have a sanctuary, and information from the Donkey Breed Society and the press indicated there were two similar projects running. One, Miss Philpin's Donkey Sanctuary near Reading, a registered charity, and the other, Mr. Lockwood at Godalming, who was not registered. It seemed better to put our activities on a proper footing, and after a long time discussing it with the Donkey Breed Society and also with our lawyers, we applied to become a registered charity in October 1972, with Niels and me as trustees, and with the approval of the Donkey Breed Society. John Lovell, a great friend and also a lawyer, coped with all the paperwork required, and in March 1973, the South Western Donkey Sanctuary became registered. We just didn't have enough room for the number of donkeys that were coming in. Donkeys need quite a large amount of space, even for exercise, and it was quite obvious that to continue taking in donkeys, we were going to need more. A lot of local interest had been shown in a countryside park which opened within a few miles of the hotel, and so I went to see the owner, Mrs. Judith Forbes. She was extremely sympathetic and proudly showed me round her lovely park. If I would be prepared to fence and put some buildings up, she would be prepared to let me have 12 acres of land for the fitter donkeys to roam on. This seemed like an answer to a prayer, and having thanked her, I rushed back home to tell Niels. There he was, sitting in his office at the hotel, staring miserably at a set of figures he had just got out for the year's turnover. "I think you had better sit down, darling," he said, "and let's both talk about money." It was quite obvious to both of us what was happening. Any profit which we made from the hotel was quite literally being eaten by the donkeys. There just weren't enough funds to do the necessary fencing at Farway, and unless I was able to start organising finances on my own for the donkeys, we wouldn't be able to take any more in and keep the hotel going. We desperately needed 3 more stables at Salston Close to look after the fit donkeys we had, and the first quotation for the fencing was £600. We spent a very worrying week trying to work out ways of raising more funds, and then, suddenly, help appeared. Rosalind de Wesselow, a fellow member of the Donkey Breed Society, had a good friend, Colonel Gerald Critchley, of the Home of Rest for Horses. They also had a great interest in donkeys, and thanks to Rosalind's help, and a trip on my part to London, the home very kindly agreed to pay our fencing costs. That gave us the encouragement we so badly needed to keep going. At this time, the Down Your Way team from the long-established radio programme, visiting different towns in different parts of the country, arrived in Ottery, and I was rather amused on their arrival. They signed in at the reception desk of our hotel where they were staying to do the programme, and asked me behind the desk, assuming I was the receptionist, We hear there is an eccentric donkey lady lives somewhere near here. Could you tell us where we could contact her? After a few embarrassing moments, it was all cleared up, and they did an interview which focused the attention of donkey lovers throughout the country on the work we were struggling to do on our own. A disturbing result of the programme was that 5 more donkeys arrived, their owners having taken note of our address. One was a walking skeleton. She became Twiggy, naturally. She arrived as we were building our new isolation block of stables. We were learning fast. Each new arrival seemed to spread a different ailment around our population, and it seemed new families of lice were ready and willing to change owners at a minute's notice. We developed a system so that each arrival was put in the isolation block for a period of 3 weeks. During this period of time, the most important thing was to get the confidence of the donkey. Donkeys like Twiggy, who had been starved almost to the point of death, had also frequently been mistreated. And before we could start making any real physical improvement, we had to help them to regain their faith in human beings. It always seemed worthwhile, when I had time, to stand quietly in a box, gently stroking the muzzle of a donkey, which had probably never known any kindness before in its life, and Twiggy survived. So many of them were covered with bleeding sores and infested with lice, and I found it very hard to accept that human beings had inflicted such terrible hardship on poor, innocent creatures. I love them. When a new donkey arrived, the vet called as soon as he could to give the donkeys a full medical check, and we also had a visit from the farrier, as mostly the donkeys' feet were absolutely appalling, and until they were paired back so the donkeys could stand properly, they suffered considerable discomfort and pain. Some arrivals could barely walk, and my heart would sink as I saw them lurching from the lorries. I kept a tightly fitting headscarf and a polo neck shirt at the ready, and started to groom the donkeys to clear the lice. With the children, of course, I had got used to tide marks round the bath, but I had to try to get used to lice marks after my work was done. The lice never seemed to bite or to irritate me, but it's hard to get used to the feeling of being crawled over. The very large lumps of matted hair had to be cut out patiently, and a large pair of kitchen scissors came in handy. Many a shaggy coat was tangled beyond hope, and with running sores beneath, the only way to prevent further suffering was to clip the coat, bit by bit, with scissors. I always talk quietly whilst I work, and the donkeys never seem to mind or grow impatient. Somehow, they seem to appreciate what is being done. Now, with some donkeys, we have progressed to electric clippers, which are much quicker and more efficient. But I still wonder which the donkeys really prefer. I was still breeding a few donkeys, using St. Paddy as the stud stallion, and of course only using mares which we had bought for the purpose. We sold our foals when they got to 8 or 9 months old, and the money raised by getting them to good homes for a good price helped to keep the sanctuary running. Angelina and Naughtyface each had another beautiful foal. Niels and I saw an advertisement in the paper one day for a pink or strawberry roan donkey for sale. Even Niels was quite excited at the thought of this unusual colour, and so off we went to Sticklepath to buy Bambi, who was to become my husband's favourite donkey. She was indeed the most beautiful strawberry roan colour, and on her arrival back at home, we lost little time in putting her to the stallion. Supremo was born 1 year later and was the first pink and white donkey born in the country. He received a tremendous reception. Occasionally, going round to shows, I met members of the Donkey Breed Society, all of whom were interested in the work I was doing on the welfare side. Priscilla Kirby, who is a very well-known breeder and member of the society, rang me one night at home to say that she had a terrible problem. She had sold 2 of her favourite donkeys called Rosanna and Black Coffee to what she had taken to be an extremely good home. a wealthy director of some large city finance outfit who had plenty of land. Rosanna had been a show donkey until Priscilla had sold her, and Black Coffee, her daughter, was a large donkey with the gentlest nature imaginable. Like many good stud owners, Priscilla went to visit her donkeys in their new homes just after a year. To her horror, both Rosanna and Black Coffee were desperately lame, thin, and frightened, and they had had no farrier all the time they had been there. She threatened the owner with prosecution unless he let her have them. Could I possibly take them because they were in such terrible condition? She didn't feel she could cope with them in her stud, and she would pay their expenses to get them down to me, she asked. Within a very short time, Rosanna and Black Coffee arrived. It took us 3 years to get them right. It was amazing how thin and emaciated they had become in 1 year of neglect, and it made me worried that I occasionally had to sell my foals to make sufficient money to keep the sanctuary running.